I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is violence against women in this episode. Please take care where and when you listen.
As strange as this story may seem, this is a work of nonfiction with no invented dialogue. Every reenactment you hear comes from government files, archives, diaries, letters, newspaper articles, books, or trial testimony. It's the morning of October 6, 1927. George Remus chases his wife Imogene into the Springhouse Gazebo in Cincinnati's Eden Park, where he rams a pistol into her belly and pulls the trigger. 4 hours later, Remus is once again behind bars, this time on the top floor of the Hamilton County Jail. His first visitor arrives at 2 p.m., a man who introduces himself as Dr. W.C. Kendig, the county alienist, a doctor who treats the insane.
Mr. Remus, I have been sent over here by the prosecutor's office to make an examination of you.
Very well, doctor. Go ahead and just go as far as you'd like. I am perfectly normal in every respect.
The doctor keeps the tone of his voice calm and even.
Your plea will not be insanity?
Emphatically, no, it will not.
Remus responds to Dr. Kendig's questions calmly, but every time the conversation calls for him to use the word wife, he chooses a more colorful phrase.
That decomposed mass of clay was not well educated, but she was a very shrewd and attractive woman. While I was confined to the penitentiary in Atlanta, this decomposed mass of clay and her pimp broke up my home, robbed me of my fortune, and double-crossed the federal government. They took everything from my house except the pearl-handled revolver I used with which she met her death. And now I've gone from George Remus the millionaire to George Remus the murderer.
Remus isn't morose or remorseful. In fact, he seems excited.
Are you insane?
Positively no. But then, no man could be perfectly sane and commit the crime that I've done.
I'm Abbott Kaler, and this is the final episode of Remus, the Mad Bootleg King. While George Remus chased Imogene, the prosecuting attorney of Hamilton County, Charles P. Taft II, or Charlie, as his friends called him, said goodbye to his wife, and drove downtown to his office on the fourth floor of the courthouse. Charlie had just returned from the Taft family cottage in Murray Bay, Canada. The family had celebrated the 70th birthday of Charlie's father, William Howard Taft, the former President of the United States and current Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. The extended Taft family had spent a month of languorous days swimming in the clear, chilly water. In the evenings, they dined and danced until midnight. But Charlie's good mood vanished when he walked into a Cincinnati office and was met by the grim faces of his colleagues. They told him there had been a brutal murder that morning. On the way to his divorce hearing, the bootlegger George Remus had shot his wife in Eden Park and was now in custody. Taft did not need to hear another word about the situation to recognize its significance. The Remus case would be the most important of his career. Charlie Taft had just turned 30 years old. Less than a year earlier, he had been elected Hamilton County's prosecuting attorney. With just one conviction to his record, he was currently enmeshed in a trial against an influential Cincinnati bootlegger named George Fat Rassman, who stood accused of killing a speakeasy proprietor. But his best efforts were being stymied by the skill of Rassman's defense attorney, 36-year-old Charles Elston. Once a prosecutor himself, Elston anticipated Taft's strategies and arguments before he made them and was not averse to bold and risky tactics. In one recent murder trial, Elston represented a young man charged with firing two shots into a police officer's chest. Elston argued the defendant had been weak mentally from boyhood and was insane at the time he committed murder. With that in mind, Charlie Taft realized that George Remus might also plead insanity. The next day in municipal court, Remus pled not guilty. On his way out, reporters asked if he'd hired a lawyer to assist with his case. With a flourish, he produced two telegrams from his pocket, both from prominent attorneys who had offered to defend him. Remus said he declined.
George Remus will defend George Remus. I am now George Remus the lawyer, not George Remus the bootlegger.
3 days later, the crafty defense lawyer Elston emerged victorious over Taft in the Rassman trial, and Remus made an announcement.
At the earnest solicitation of my friends, I have decided to have attorney Elston associated with me in my trial. Remus will handle his own defense, but Mr. Elston will be associated with him.
Together, they began debating the first order of business, trial strategy. Remus had pled not guilty, but by reason of what? One option was justifiable homicide. They could catalog Imogene's undeniable offenses, like her theft of his money and assets, her betrayal with Dodge, and argue that her deplorable behavior warranted a deadly response. She was an immoral woman, and therefore Remus was morally right to kill her. Theirs would be history's oldest and most common defense. The second option was temporary insanity. The scaffolding would be the same, using Imogene's own treachery to explain what precipitated her death. But they would build an entirely different case around those facts. They would argue that if Imogene had remained faithful, Remus never would have suffered brainstorms. Those momentary lapses in consciousness obliterated all rational thought. Temporary insanity would explain the shooting stars and the gleaming halo that followed him, whispering murderous commands. Remus knew well the legal precedents for the temporary insanity defense. In fact, Remus had used it to defend a Chicago client who had murdered his wife. The man was convicted, but based on Remus's insanity defense, he was spared the electric chair and given a sentence of only 15 years in prison. Now, with his own life on the line, Remus intended to improve upon that outcome. He would plead temporary insanity. He would take all the symptoms he'd exhibited over the past 2 years, the raving, the violent fits, the catatonic spells, and create a narrative of madness, inviting jurors to experience the downfall of his mind. He summarized his defense in just 3 words.
Remus's brain exploded.
On Monday, November 14th, George Remus prepared to make legal history, becoming the first person to act as his own attorney after pleading insanity. On its face, it was absurd. Reporters and opinion writers across the country peppered their columns with questions and theories. If George Remus the accused is insane, then why isn't George Remus the attorney insane? If George Remus the accused is insane, was he in a fit condition to employ George Remus as attorney? Furthermore, if George Remus the attorney is insane, shouldn't he disqualify himself from representing George Remus the accused? Escorted by a bailiff, Remus arrived at the Hamilton County Common Pleas Court wearing a blue suit, a crisply starched cream shirt, a black tie adorned with a pearl, black shoes and socks, and tortoiseshell eyeglasses, clearly playing the part of a seasoned attorney rather than deranged defendant. It was the day after his 51st birthday. Smiling, he greeted spectators, housewives, doctors, businessmen, laborers, all of whom had lined up at sunrise to vie for one of the 110 seats in the courtroom. County deputies had to turn 900 people away. A special section housed reporters from every major newspaper in the country. Fearing that the intense media scrutiny would affect the proceedings, Judge Chester Shook banned telegraph equipment, typewriters, tripod cameras, and flash photography from the courtroom. Judge Shook had been elected to the court only a year earlier, his first public office. He was determined to conduct his highest profile trial with dignity and decorum. Remus took his place beside co-counsel Charles Elston. At the table to their right sat Charlie Taft and his assistant prosecutor, both of them sons of Cincinnati High Society. Remus once hoped men like them would attend his parties. Now, at last, he had their attention.
Call the jury.
As jury selection proceeded, the prosecution worked relentlessly to drive home a key point. If Remus was insane when he killed Imogene, then he could not be sane enough to represent himself now. Their attack began as Remus examined the very first juror.
Would the fact that I am charged here with murder and the fact that I am participating in the presentation of my own defense prejudice you against me?
Before the man could answer, Taft's assistant prosecutor rose to object.
It is ridiculous to think that an insane man should question and examine jurors.
Elston rose and responded.
The claim of the defense is that the defendant was insane at the time the crime was committed.
This confused Judge Shook.
Does the defense say the defendant is insane now?
The defense says that Remus was insane at the time of the crime. His condition now is a question to be decided through the evidence in this case.
Shook agreed with Elston and overruled the prosecution's objection. Remus had won this early round. The court had determined him mentally competent to question his own jurors. Judge Shook gave each side 2 hours for opening statements. The assistant prosecutor spoke first. He suggested that Remus had long planned the murder and his insanity defense with his associate George Connors, his accountant Blanche Watson, and his chauffeur George Klug. He argued that throughout their planning, Remus was never, not even for a moment, insane.
After we have shown you that this defendant, in a cold-blooded manner, deliberately, purposely, intentionally, and maliciously shot and killed this defenseless woman, we feel we will be justified in asking you to return a verdict that will carry with it the extreme penalty.
When the prosecution rested, Charles Elston stood and faced the jury.
We expect to show you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that at the time George Remus fired the shot that took the life of Imogene Remus, he was not a free agent and was not a sane and normal man and was not capable of entertaining premeditation, deliberation, malice and purpose, and intent to kill.
Then Elston laid out precisely how Imogene's infidelity had driven George Remus insane and introduced the story's villain, Franklin Dodge. He told the jury how Dodge's affair with Imogene had put Remus into a grievous mental state that he suffered for 2 years until the day he fired that shot.
Ms. Remus announced that she intended to marry Dodge when she got her divorce. The defendant turned these things over in his mind 1,000 times a day. The more he thought about them, the more they preyed on his mind and tortured him.
That set the dynamic for the entire trial. Did Remus conspire with Connors and the others to plan Imogene's murder and to follow it with an insanity defense? Or did Imogene's affair with Dodge drive Remus insane, only for him to become sane again the moment after he killed her? The prosecutors pushed the premeditated theory hard. They argued that Klug, Connors, and the accountant Blanche Watson had hatched their whole plan in Remus's room at the Sinton Hotel. Their greatest hope for proving it involved a significant risk, calling the chauffeur, George Klug, to the stand.
How long were you in the hotel room with Remus, George Connors, and Blanche Watson?
Only about 5 or 10 minutes, and nobody else was in there outside of Mr. Remus.
The prosecutor's face reddened with anger, and he shouted at Klug.
Mr. Klug, when you were up in the prosecutor's office 2 weeks ago, you said there were several people in that room.
I did no such thing.
Who have you been talking to about this case since you talked to me?
I've not been talking to anyone about this case.
For the next 5 hours of grueling examination, Klug denied everything he had told the prosecutors in front of the grand jury 2 weeks earlier. Finally, Remus had enough of the conspiracy talk.
May I address the court, Your Honor? The specific charge that the defendant is charged with is the willful, malicious, and wanton killing of the deceased.
Remus argued that the prosecution had introduced the conspiracy theory, that Remus had planned the murder and his insanity plea along with his associates. If Taft wanted to make that argument, Remus said, he should therefore have to prove not only the murder, but also the conspiracy. Judge Shook made a surprising ruling. He faced Charlie Taft and told him he agreed with Remus. Taft would now have to prove both. It was a harsh blow to the prosecution.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Shook ordered him to sit. Remus obeyed, laughing hysterically all the while.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode. And I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
After 2 weeks, Taft rested his case. Elston began the defense's arguments, calling a parade of witnesses who testified to Remus's insanity. Former federal prosecutor A. Lee Beatty.
Remus came into my office, and he said that the government was conspiring with members of some gang to take his life. He said one of them was very high in the service of the Department of Justice.
That person was none other than
Mabel Walker Willebrandt.
A reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch described a visit in 1925 to Remus's nearly empty mansion.
He began raving, and he stamped up and down the front room, and he pulled at his head, and he said, "This is driving me mad. No man ever had to bear what I had to bear." Sometimes he would walk a little while, and he would be as solemn and sonorous as an archbishop. Then he would jump like a man with a hornet in his pants and tear around the room. I reached the conclusion that he was exceptionally intelligent and sane and bright and shrewd about everything except that one subject. And that subject was crazy as a bedbug.
A newspaper artist with the Cincinnati Post also recalled a visit to Remus's home, this time in 1927.
He was quite wild. He was trying to get into the house. He couldn't get in. The door was locked. The windows were all locked. He had some kind of instrument in his hand, and he pried open the window and managed to get the door open on the inside, and he let us in. Every time he would come to an empty room, he would start singing in a peculiar way. He would holler and shout and sing in a very peculiar manner.
Did you reach any conclusion in your mind to his sanity or insanity?
On the subject of Mrs. Remus and Franklin Dodge, he was quite off. He would go wild every time you mentioned it.
Charlie Taft and his co-prosecutor tallied up this deja vu testimony. So similar in tone and theme, it seemed the witnesses had followed a script, especially these tours of Remus's empty mansion. Some of them occurred on adjacent days, meaning Remus had to restage his home as though it were the first time he'd seen it, relocking windows and doors that had already been opened, hiring a locksmith to participate in this charade, feigning surprise and despair at each ransacked room. If the witnesses were following a script, it was one that Remus himself had written. Wasn't this evidence of premeditation? In his cross-examinations, Taft challenged every witness. Didn't they see that these outbursts were staged for the benefit of the press and other potentially useful witnesses? But it didn't matter. The witnesses testified that Remus's disturbing behavior was clear evidence that the man had been cruelly wronged, and definitely not a mere performance he gave when it suited him. Finally, after 6 long weeks of trial, the defense rested. Judge Shook gave each side 4 hours for closing statements. Remus decided that he would deliver his own. He believed he was ready. He knew that the unusual spectacle of a murder defendant, particularly one of his theatrical prowess, pleading for his own life, would draw international attention. Remus knew that hundreds were clamoring to hear him, lined up on Main Street in the cold. Wearing a light gray suit, he paced back and forth in front of the jury box, and then began.
Here before you stands Remus the lawyer.
Then, with a flourish, he swung his arm and pointed at his empty chair behind the defense table.
In the chair there sits Remus the defendant, charged with murder.
His plan was to spend 4 hours driving that point home. That Remus the lawyer, now perfectly sane in front of the jury, was not the same person as Remus the defendant, who had been perfectly insane when he had killed his wife. But his brain was at war with him. He had so many other points he wanted to make. He wanted to talk about the essential nature of insanity. He wanted to talk about Imogene's betrayal with Franklin Dodge, that social leper, that human parasite. He wanted to explain how Imogene Dodge had sold off all his assets while he sat in prison. The reporters in the room watched him grow flustered. They saw unease and desperation. They saw him veer wildly from one rhetorical path to another. The meandering speeches and mental meltdown continued until Judge Shook warned him that he had only 5 minutes left. Remus spun back to the jury and delivered his final plea, addressing the 12 men and women as if they were the only people in the room.
Let every one of you go home and be content. I, the defendant, do not desire any sympathy in any way, shape, or form or manner. If
Few folks feel that under your sworn duty, as ladies and men of this jury, you that have a higher power than the President of the United States as to the guilt or innocence of this defendant, if you feel that he should be electrocuted, do your duty. Don't flinch. The defendant won't flinch. The defendant stands before you, defending his honor and the sanctity of his home. The defendant is on trial for that. And if that is murder, punish him. As you retire into the consideration of your verdict, bear in mind that that which is most sacred, most beautiful, most glorious to all of us is our family, our offspring, our home. I thank you, and a Merry Christmas to you.
As the Cincinnati Enquirer put it, Remus had failed to click, but Charlie Taft still worried. He requested that Judge Shook not give the jury a chance to render a straight not guilty verdict, which would allow Remus to avoid both jail and the insane asylum. Since Remus had admitted killing his wife and had pleaded insanity, Taft argued, it followed that he must be found insane or be given a heavier sentence. Judge Shook agreed, ruling that Remus could be found not guilty only by reason of insanity. Before he sent them away to deliberate, Judge Shook told the jury that they had five possible verdicts. First-degree murder without mercy, which meant the electric chair. First-degree murder with mercy, life without parole. Second-degree murder, life but with the possibility of parole. Manslaughter, a jail sentence of up to 20 years. And finally, not guilty by reason of insanity. He sent them into the jury room at exactly 12:59 p.m. Precisely 1 hour and 55 minutes later, the jury foreman rapped at the door. No one had expected such a speedy verdict. The courtroom was still empty, and sheriffs spent the next hour searching the streets for the lawyers and fetching Remus from the jail. Anxious spectators shoved their way through a rear door until they filled every seat and lined the walls, ignoring the maximum capacity. Judge Shook ascended his dais.
Have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Remus took off his glasses and held them at his chin. His skin was pale, and he withheld all expression. The foreman rose and handed the sealed envelope to the court clerk, who opened it with a vigorous rip and unfolded its contents. The audience in the courtroom leaned forward as he read.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty of murder as he stands charged in the indictment on the sole ground of insanity.
Remus stood up slowly and then shouted at the top of his lungs.
This is American justice. Thank you. Thank you.
Deputies led him out of the courtroom, and in the hallway, he laughed uproariously. Remus's voice teetered on hysteria. In the corridor, 500 admirers, many of them women, closed in on him, shouting congratulations into his ears and launching into a chorus. Remus began to weep fat tears. He wailed brazenly. 50 people, including several jurors, followed Remus and the deputies back to the jail. Outside Remus's cell, two of the jurors began talking to reporters.
As the evidence unfolded, I began to pity Remus and hate the prosecutor's assistants. I thought Remus must have been insane when he killed her. Anyway, I believe Remus was justified in what he did.
Why did you decide the way you did?
We felt that Remus had been greatly wronged, that he had suffered almost beyond human endurance. One of the factors that decided us was that Remus already had served in 9 jails for the violation of the prohibition law, all for the same offense.
When the press finally tracked down Charlie Taft, he had only 7 words.
It was a gross miscarriage of justice.
Charlie Taft could have said much more about the challenges he had faced in prosecuting Remus. He could have pointed out that, in Cincinnati, Remus was a folk hero. During his reign as America's bootleg king, Remus had likely employed friends and relatives of the very jury members who would decide his fate. Charlie Taft could also have mentioned that Remus alone wasn't on trial. Prohibition itself was on trial, and it had no chance in a wet city like Cincinnati. Most of all, Taft could have argued that Imogene Remus, too, was on trial. Even those who embraced the idea of the modern woman might find Imogene's behavior disturbing, proving, as it did, that women were as capable of betrayal as men, and even had the gall to hope to get away with it. All 12 members of the jury wrote a petition to Judge Shook, asking that Remus be released immediately so he could spend Christmas with his mother and his daughter Romola. Shook would have none of it and called their petition intolerable, outrageous, insulting, and audacious. Shook wanted Remus locked up in a mental hospital because he was a danger to society. He ordered Remus to testify about his state of mind in probate court.
Got any feeling about your dead wife having killed her?
None in the slightest.
No remorse?
Oh, I feel sorry to think she was unfortunate, that she would be tied up with that kind of human parasite.
Has anything ever entered your mind about what the state of her soul is? Of whether she is in heaven?
My answer is that a woman, and I mustn't use the word woman, a person who is so depraved, so degenerated as to lose all person of womankind the way she did, that whatever is in the future, in the hereafter, so far as she is concerned, cannot be bad enough.
You loved her at one time, didn't you?
Yes, there was no question about it.
On December 28th, after Remus's testimony before the probate court, 5 psychiatrists, including 2 who had observed the murder trial, testified that he was sane, but a threat to society. They called him histrionic and dangerous. They called him an amoral psychopath, emotionally unstable, subject to unrestrained outbursts of temper and rage. Nevertheless, the judge agreed with only half their findings. He ruled that while Remus was indeed too dangerous to be released, he was also insane. He committed Remus to the Lima State Hospital for the criminally insane until he has been restored to reason. On January 6, 1928, exactly 3 months after Remus killed Imogene, he arrived at Lima State Hospital. On his first Sunday at the asylum, Remus joined the church choir. A new set of alienists, 3 of whom were hired and paid by Remus, conducted lengthy interviews probing every facet of the patient's psyche. In the final week of February, Remus went to the Court of Appeals in Lima to ask for his release. One by one, Remus's hired alienists reported favorable observations. The halo Remus spoke of was possibly confusion from worry rather than a hallucination or an illusion. He wasn't insane, but merely affected by fury and violence from extreme circumstances. He seemed logical and coherent and sane beyond a doubt. The alienists who weren't in Remus's pocket dissected his personality, right down to his aversion to underwear, which they considered a sign of an unstable mind. They offered various conclusions that, when taken together, were quite inconclusive. In March, after listening to all of the alienist testimony, the Allen County District Court of Appeals found that Remus was not insane and ordered his discharge from Lima State Hospital. When told of the verdict, Remus wept with joy.
It's wonderful. I knew they would believe me.
Charlie Taft, still enraged by his defeat, beseeched the Lima authorities to deny Remus bail while the Allen County prosecutor appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court. The irony did not escape Remus. Charlie Taft, who had argued during the murder trial that Remus was perfectly sane, was now arguing the exact opposite. On June 28, 1929, the Ohio Supreme Court ruled in Remus's favor and ordered that he be released. The following Easter, during the egg hunt in Eden Park, a young boy spotted a strange object in a thicket, a rusty, pearl-handled revolver. The hunt's organizers turned it over to the police. Remus could not be found for comment. Franklin Dodge was never called to the stand during Remus's murder trial. He was later indicted by a federal grand jury in Savannah, Georgia, on 7 counts of perjury, stemming from testimony he'd given in the trial of the local bootlegger Willie Haar. Dodge was sentenced to 30 months in the Atlanta pen, where he'd first met George and Imogene Remus. After his release, he moved to Lansing, Michigan, and took a job in the city auditor's office. He lived there quietly until his death in 1968 at 77 years old. Mabel Willebrandt lasted at the Department of Justice until her resignation in June of 1929. Perhaps her greatest legacy at the department was not her pursuit of George Remus, but her ingenuity regarding tax law. It was Willebrandt who argued before the United States Supreme Court that income gained from bootlegging was subject to income tax, thereby setting the trap that would ensnare Al Capone. She built a thriving private law practice with offices in Washington and Los Angeles, where she represented the movie mogul Louis B. Mayer and film stars like Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. To the dismay of her former prohibition colleagues, she also represented a group of California grape growers who utilized a loophole in the Volstead Act allowing for the private production of table wine. Her hearing and her health kept deteriorating, and in 1962, her lifetime smoking habit resulted in a diagnosis of emphysema. She died a year later. In all of the tributes celebrating her achievements, one friend, future federal judge John J. Sirica, who would preside over the Watergate case, speculated about what might have been. If Mabel had worn trousers, he said, she could have been president. In August 1929, Ruth Remus filed a petition in probate court seeking annulment of her adoption and restoration of her former name, Ruth Holmes. Her petition was granted in October, 2 years after her mother's death. Ruth married in 1930 and within 10 years had two sons of her own. In 1947, she checked into Columbia Hospital in Milwaukee for a hysterectomy. Afterwards, she was given a blood transfusion intended for a different patient with the same name and would prove to be a fatal error. She died that evening at the age of 39. Romola Remus pursued an acting and singing career, benefiting from the notoriety of her father's crimes. Packard, the motor car company, used her name in newspaper ads boasting, "This well-known musician is accustomed to the best of all lines." The Oriole Terrace, a cabaret in Detroit, billed her as the girl who stood by her dad. Eventually, she tired of questions about her father, telling reporters and fans alike that she was trying to forget the past. When she died in February 1987, she was remembered mostly for an acting job she did when she was only 8 years old. She had played the first Dorothy in writer L. Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz. In later life, Romola lived in the uptown neighborhood of Chicago with a cat, a turtle, a parakeet, and dozens of books stuffed with her clippings. She had no immediate survivors and specified in her will that her age not be disclosed. As for the mad bootleg king, after several years of trying with little success to recoup his assets, George Remus married his accountant, Blanche Watson, in 1941. They moved to Covington, Kentucky, just across the river from Cincinnati, and lived in quiet, deliberate obscurity. Remus traveled some and was occasionally spotted by reporters at racetracks and by old acquaintances in various cities where he once closed deals and paid bribes. He said the same thing to anyone who ran into him.
"Tell no one I am here. Tell nobody you have seen me. I want to get out of the spotlight, you see."
In August 1950, he suffered a stroke while exercising at the Cincinnati gym. When he died from a cerebral hemorrhage 2 years later, at the age of 79, he was living in a boarding house under the care of a nurse. The headline of his obituary in the Cincinnati Times Star read, "Another Gatsby Passes." He was buried in Blanche Watson's family plot in Falmouth, Kentucky, in a grave distinguished from all the others nearby. A sculpture of a woman perched on the shoulders of two angels loomed over him, a sculpture rumored to have been one of the few pieces left from the mansion. One morning, soon after Remus's death, the cemetery caretaker discovered that the angels had been vandalized, their wings struck from their shoulders and reduced to cement shards at the base of the tombstone. As the legend has it, someone had written a letter to Watson arguing that Remus was not fit to be guarded by angels. For reasons known only to her, Watson set out to the cemetery, hammer in hand, and with a few hard blows demolished what remained of the wings. Legend also has it that Imogene Remus still haunts Eden Park, wandering around the bank of Mirror Lake, always pausing by the Springhouse gazebo, where, on a fall morning in a different, distant time, she realized that she was about to die. She wears the same black Parisian hat and sleek silk dress, now clean of dirt and blood. Most of the time she's silent, gazing into the reflecting pool, content to let the world rush around her. On other nights, and it is always at night, she runs, wild and sobbing, as though she still hears his footsteps behind her and feels the heat of him closing in. I'm Abbott Kaler. You've been listening to Remus, the Mad Bootleg King. To read the complete story of George Remus's life and this wild chapter in American history, read my book, The Ghosts of Eden Park. Remus, the Mad Bootleg King, is a co-production of iHeart Podcasts and School of Humans. It's hosted by me, Abbott Kaler. Chuck Reese and I wrote the show. Our producer is Miranda Hawkins. Our senior producer is Jessica Metzger. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Sound design and mix by Chris Childs. Elise McCoy composed original music. Additional scoring by Chris Childs. Voices in this episode provided by Ben Bolin, Noel Brown, Matt Frederick, Lou Carlozzo, Jonathan Sleep, Joel Ruiz, Van Gunter, Fleet Cooper, Jay Jones, Jeremy Thal, Tiago Macklin, Zubin Hensler, Nicole Britton, and Judah Andrews. Special thanks to John Higgins from CuriosityStream and the team at CDM Studios in New York. Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give it a review in your podcast app. You can also check out other Curiosity podcasts to learn about history, pop culture, true crime, and more.
School of Humans.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge the season of The Passage now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.